This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Good morning to you. I am Andrew Pitts, in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC's Breakfast Show. The election is barely 6 weeks away. We had the first question and answer session last night with Jeremy Paxman putting both David Cameron and Ed Miliband through their paces. Who do you think fared best? Theo Ashworth, LBC's political editor, was observing the proceedings. Morning, Theo.
Good morning, Andrew.
What do you make of it all, Theo?
Yes, now, of course, there was no head-to-head debate, was there, Andrew? But in terms of drama, the Jeremy Paxman grilling particularly made up for it. Now, Mr. Paxman has described himself, hasn't he, as a one-nation Tory. But he didn't hold back when it came to interviewing David Cameron, launching in with his first question about food banks.
If you look at what's happened with our economy, there are 1.89 million more people in work than when I became Prime Minister. We've got 900,000 fewer people on out-of-work benefits.
Is an increase in food banks a mark of success?
No, look, obviously there has been an increase in food bank use. That's partly because of, you know, the difficulties we faced as a country. It's also, Jeremy, because we changed the rules. The previous government didn't allow job centres to advertise the existence of food banks. They thought it would be bad PR.
Now, Ed Miliband didn't escape the tough questions either, Andrew. The pick of them, this one about the relationship with his brother David after he beat him to the Labour leadership.
It was a difficult contest between me and David, and it was a bruising contest. Why did I stand? I thought somebody needed to lead the Labour Party who could move us on from New Labour, because I thought that was the time that was necessary for the country and necessary for our party.
Now, Mr. Miliband also insisted that he was tough enough to lead the country. He was asked repeatedly by Mr. Paxman whether he could stand up to the likes of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Look, you need a toughness in this job. Mm. You need a toughness. People have thrown a lot at me over 4.5 years, right? But I'm a pretty resilient guy. And I've been underestimated at every turn. People said I wouldn't become leader, and I did. People said 4 years ago he can't become Prime Minister. I think I can. You're saying I can't win a majority. I think I can. So let people underestimate me. But what I care about is what is happening to the British people in their lives. And I think I can change it. And I know I'm the right man for the job. That's why I'm sitting here. And that's why I believe that I'm the best choice to be Prime Minister.
Now, Jeremy Paxman also asked the Prime Minister about his friendship with Jeremy Clarkson. The Top Gear presenter, of course, has been sacked by the BBC. When David Cameron was asked initially about it on a local BBC radio show, he defended Mr. Clarkson. But last night, he decided to row back from that defence.
If you want to raise the issue of Jeremy Clarkson, I said very clearly I didn't know what had happened, and so I wasn't going to comment extensively. I just simply answered a question I was asked, explaining he was a friend of mine, he's a talent, and I hope it could be resolved. But I'm absolutely clear, look, treating the people you work with badly is not acceptable. The BBC have made their decision.
Well, that's Theo. Polls showed that Cameron shaded it by 8 points, or 6 points, considering. But I think Miliband won more of the undecideds.
Yes, he did. The polls last night, the ICM poll put it at 54 to 46 for David Cameron. The Times have a poll of 51 to 49. But if you look at the undecideds, those that share the vote who have yet to make up their mind whether to vote Labour or to vote Tory, Labour came out on top 56 to 30, and the rest, the remainder, hadn't made up their minds still. What was interesting about tonight, last night, and what we have to remember is that when it comes to the personal approval ratings, David Cameron was certainly streaks ahead. He was 20 points up on Ed Miliband. So for it to be so close is a real victory for Team Miliband, and it'll be interesting to see when we get the latest figures, the latest approval ratings, how close that gap is now. If it's less than, if it's around 5-10 points, I'm sure Ed Miliband and his entourage will be very happy with that.
You saw them last night, Theo. Did you detect that Team Miliband was more content than Team Cameron?
Team Cameron was very relaxed about this debate. I remember I was talking to some of his people, and they were, you know, he'd done a bit of light homework. He hadn't spent a huge amount of time boning up on particular issues. He was cool and he was relaxed. Ed Miliband, Kay Burley said, was very, very nervous beforehand. But actually, when it came to that grilling, both by the audience and by Jeremy Paxman, Ed Miliband did perform much, much better. And you'll remember on Wednesday, he had a disaster, an absolute horror show at PMQs. Cameron wiped the floor with him, 6-0. And on that issue, particularly of whether the Tories would raise VAT, and Cameron ruled it out. So Ed Miliband really had to put in a very strong performance last night, and he did that.
So they'll go into the next debates. We've got the seven-way debate coming up, Theo. Do you think their confidence will be higher in the Labour camp?
Yes, it will, but The seven-way debate poses much more of a problem, in my opinion, for Ed Miliband than it does for David Cameron, because Ed Miliband has to worry about Nicola Sturgeon from the SNP. He also has to think about how he's going to deal with Nick Clegg, because, of course, wavering Lib Dem voters unhappy with things like the tuition fees are core key votes that Ed Miliband has to win over. So there's much more for him to do, much more of an opportunity for him to either take or to waste going into that seven-way debate.
OK, that's Theo Ashwood. He's LBC's political editor, commenting on last night. It was the first debate. They weren't head-to-head, of course, because the Prime Minister refuses to do a head-to-head with Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg. But the polls showed, the ICM poll in The Guardian gave it 54 to 46 for Cameron. But those undecideds, they were quite decisively in favour of Ed Miliband. Well, who did you think won last night's contest? Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader. Nigel, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Who did you score it for?
Well, let's be clear, Andrew, it wasn't a debate. There was no debate. And that really is the saddest part of all of this, is that ever since this process started, the Prime Minister has done everything he can to scupper proper debate. So, given that it was two interviews, the winner was Jeremy Paxman by quite some margin. On policy terms, I thought Ed Miliband had absolutely nothing to offer whatsoever. I didn't leave that interview understanding anything that the Labour Party really stood for. But on personality, I think it was rather different. I was very surprised at how nervous Cameron looked, really discomforted for sort of the first 16 of the 18 minutes. And he really had a bit of a mare. Whereas Miliband, who took some quite close personal questioning and actually responded very robustly and with humour, you know, and got the audience laughing. So I think in terms of personalities, Miliband exceeded expectations and did better than David Cameron.
If you had to score it, though, Nigel, taking into account policy, presentation of policy, I thought Cameron did better with the audience rather than with Paxman. Overall, on the night, who won?
With Paxman, without a doubt, it was Miliband.
And with the audience?
Probably just about sneak it. For Cameron. But in terms of, as I say, in terms of personality, I think Ed surprised everybody. He was tough and he was funny.
Are you looking forward to finally getting into a debate situation with seven of you?
Yeah, why not increase it and have a dozen? It's going to be very difficult to have a proper debate with seven people. And even though it's a two-hour programme, we'll be lucky to get through more than four questions. I'm personally very sad that Ofcom, you know, ruled that UKIP was the fourth major party in British politics, and that was the day that Cameron started his shenanigans. So, yes, I'm looking forward to it, but I don't think it'll be as good a spectacle as perhaps it should have been.
And just finally, Nigel, do you think their debate last night has made any real difference to people's voting intentions? We talked to, earlier, Ipsos Mori, Ben Page, and he said he didn't think it was a game changer at all.
No, I don't think it was. And if you're one of those people, which is now a majority, you know, it is the biggest opinion. If you're one of those people who thinks immigration is the key issue in this election, nothing was offered to you last night whatsoever.
That's Nigel Farage, the distinctive voice of Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader, of course, who was excluded from that debate last night. But, of course, when they have all seven together, Mr. Farage will be punching, and I suspect punching pretty hard. Who won for you last night? Cameron? Or Miliband, or was it Jeremy Paxman? 0345 6060 973. Chris is in South Croydon. Morning.
Oh, morning, Andrew.
Who won for you?
Well, I think personally, Cameron just shaded it, but I must say I was profoundly disappointed with Jeremy Paxman's performance. He completely belied his Rottweiler reputation, because he never followed up. I mean, for a start, he never asked the question, Labour have screwed up the economy three times in the past 4 years. Why is it going to be any different the next time? The other thing he didn't press him on was immigration. The point never came out that as long as we're in the EU, we've got no control over our borders, and there is nothing to stop our population going up 80 million, 90 million. And the other thing, he let him get away with this assertion of it was a bank meltdown, lack of regulation of the banks. He didn't pursue the point. It was Labour's gross irresponsible overspending.
So
very disappointed in Paxman, to tell you the truth, above all.
Well, that's an interesting take, Chris, because if you look at the newspapers, certainly this morning, they're all giving, a lot of people are saying it was Paxman what won it. Jay's in Tottenham. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
How is it for you?
For me, it was a bit of an experience. Obviously, I was on the fence of who I was going to vote for at the time. So obviously, I used this interview to gauge my decision, and I personally felt that David Cameron come across really unhonest. I really didn't understand any. When he answered the question, he seemed to always dodge his answers. I mean, and he just came across as somebody that really just cared about the rich people in the city. I mean, Nigel Farage goes on and talks about immigration, but the real inner-city people who live in these areas don't really care about that. I mean, they care about their housing, they care about their education, and they care about the well-being of their families. And I personally think that David Cameron just didn't really care about, didn't really connect with me. And I thought that Ed Miliband did. I really thought he was honest.
So you're
in his answers, in his opinions.
So you were a floating voter before last night.
Yeah, I was.
Jay. I
was.
And where
I really
are you now?
Was a floating voter. I think I'm with Labour. Coming from an inner city area like myself, born and raised in an area that really isn't, you know, up on David Cameron's agenda, I really felt that he didn't really touch me. Well, I didn't really identify with him on TV. I mean, obviously, Ed Miliband comes across as a bit soft, and obviously, Jeremy Paxman obviously, you know, grilled him on that. But for me, he came across as quite honest.
Okay.
I mean, if I saw him in the street and I asked him a question, I think he'd give me an honest answer.
All right, yeah. Jay, thank you for that. That's Jay, a floating voter.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC.
This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Let's not be picky. We move on, Deputy Prime Minister.
Mark in Ipswich. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning to you both. Thank you
Hello.
For taking my call. Mr. Clegg, Deputy Prime Minister, I've had a lot of friends being ex-forces who have suffered from mental health issues. And for many years, in fact, in 2009, I attended a conference on mental health and trying to break the taboo, the public taboo that surrounds mental health. Now, I think one of the things that really brought mental health to the fore was the tragic death of Gary Speed, the ex-Football and Wales manager, and that was in 2011, if I remember rightly. Now, Mr. Clegg, you've been in government for nearly 5 years. And it's only recently, as part of your pre-election promise, you've taken a public interest in mental health.
No.
Whilst I commend the fact that you have publicly come out and said that there needs to be less of a taboo and there needs to be more money for it, why the heck haven't you done this before? You've had nearly five years to do this.
So, Mark, I utterly reject this idea that something I've done. I mean, actually, one of the first questions I ever asked shortly after I became leader of the Liberal Democrats 7 years ago in Prime Minister's Questions, and I think I was one of the first people to ever do so at Prime Minister's Questions at that sort of level, was to raise mental health. It's something I've campaigned on all my political life, and far from just taking sort of recent steps, soon after we came into government, I made sure that we changed the legal mandate of the NHS to give mental health and physical health the same legal status and significance in the NHS. We then, very shortly after we came into office, announced £400 million to increase talking therapies. Subsequent to that, £150 million I announced for additional investment into helping particularly teenagers with eating disorders. As of next month, on April the 5th, because of decisions I took some years ago, because it obviously takes some time to prepare these things, there will be access and waiting time standards, Mark, operating in mental health in the NHS for the first time ever. So from April the 5th, in a few days' time, April the 5th, if you suffer from depression, you will be, the majority of people who are suffering from depression will be seen within a specified six-week period, just as you would have an access or waiting time standard entitlement for a physical health issue. And as you I hope saw last week, I also actually announced additional money for, which has been agreed and it's going to happen, to invest in the help given to veterans with mental health problems. And that was following many visits I've made, most recently in Colchester, to organisations who help veterans with mental health issues. So, do I think everything can be transformed, Mark, overnight? No, of course not. Can you change something from a standing start just like that with a sort of flick of a switch? No, of course not, because this is the result of years, if not decades, of underinvestment in mental health. But I firmly reject this idea that somehow this is some sort of last-minute idea. It's something I've been campaigning on for close to the last, in fact, all my political life.
Let me try and get some email questions into our conversation. Deputy Prime Minister Anthony in Kent asks, was the BBC right to let Jeremy Clarkson go?
If that's their judgment as his employer,
but what
then...
do you think? Do your sons watch Top Gear?
Yeah. Yeah.
They like it?
Yeah, sure.
Well, they would, young
lots
men.
Lots of people do. Lots of people do.
Sure. Will they miss him? Is he sort of one of...
Yeah, I'm sure they will. By the way, lots of people... But, I mean, look, to be fair to the BBC, Tony Hall, the head of the BBC, has said, look, he's a great entertainer. Lots of people will miss him. That's not the issue. The issue is something related to an event which I'm not... Simply wasn't...
You must have a view. Listen, as a bloke.
If he's done what the BBC say he's done, and punch someone, abuse someone, so on, then I think they're perfectly in their right as an employer to say, we no longer want to employ you. And it's not really for me or anybody else to start second-guessing their sort of management decision. Do I think he'll be a loss as an entertainer on Top Gear? Well, obviously, he's an incredibly effective entertainer. But they're two separate things. What happened in that hotel in Yorkshire, and whether my kids like Top Gear, are two, you know, separate things.
Are you going to be throwing bricks at the television tonight when you see Ed Miliband and David Cameron taking part in this sort of debate? But it's not a debate, being interviewed, but you're not being interviewed.
Well, of course I would have liked to have been part of that.
Why didn't they want you?
I wasn't invited to be part of that. And nor have I been invited to be part of the debate in a few weeks' time, and in the one in which David Cameron and I are not taking part. And look, the debates are now going to happen as they are. I welcome the fact they are going to happen now, finally, after this endless sort of to-ing and fro-ing. Would I, in principle, have wanted to take part in all of every
stage?
You
going to watch it?
Well, no, I'll be in Sheffield, actually.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yes, inviting
Chris to...
Having had that bruising hustings at a school. How old are the children?
To the Soviet, Siberian-style closed prison.
How many letters from Prince Charles have you received?
I don't think I have. I mean, I've obviously met him on a number of occasions.
The judgment is due later today on whether the government has blocked publication of letters to certain ministers in which it is alleged Prince Charles sought to express his views. How helpful would it be for us to have some light shed on this and know what Prince Charles thinks?
Look, I mean, this I think relates to correspondence, you know, going back to previous governments, and it's not really for me as a member of this government to start sort of trying to reopen the correspondence.
Well, there's been a Supreme Court ruling, I think, almost any minute.
But do I think that when Prince Charles sent those letters, he's entitled to assume that they were, you know, they would remain private? I think he probably is, but that's exactly what this case is all about.
So do you think we should see them?
I think there's a perfectly legitimate role to say at a certain point that, you know, that correspondence like that, since it was intended to be private, should remain private.
OK. And lastly, police conducted, it is reported, spying operations on a string of Labour politicians during the 1990s, so says a whistleblowing former undercover police officer. Politicians such as Jack Straw, Diane Abbott, Ken Livingstone, and others, even the late Bernie Grant.
I think it's just... I mean, if this is right, it's absolutely terrible. I mean, the idea of police... the police... sort of snooping and monitoring elected politicians, in effect because of their views. I mean, that's the implication of this, is that because they were sort of deemed to be from the left, that they were somehow sort of dodgy, absolutely appalls me. And I know there's an inquiry, Theresa May has announced a wider inquiry into undercover police tactics. I think it's called the Pitchford Inquiry. And I very much hope it'll look at these allegations, because they're not the kind of thing you want in a free society. Politicians, regardless of their views, should be able to, you know, represent their constituents and express their opinions without being monitored by the police.
And lastly, I'm pleased I got an email come in from a woman, because we haven't had a lot of female representation, and this is put right by a Wendy in Dartford, who said, you asked Nick Clegg about going on Mumsnet as making sure more women become MPs.
Mm.
What's Wendy on about there, Deputy Prime Minister?
So I was on Mumsnet I did it after Prime Minister's questions yesterday. I thought I'd do my own question and answer session, which was great.
Well, what's this? And what have we been doing for two and a half years?
And the issue was raised.
You want more female MPs?
Yes, there are. They're just, well, clearly there are not nearly enough women MPs in the Liberal Democrats. There aren't enough women in Parliament generally.
Well, it puts off women off. I appreciate you're not one, but what do you suppose puts them? Is it a bit too boisterous and yaboo and
I think the way in which Westminster works and all this kind of testosterone-driven macho yelling is pretty off-putting to any normal person, to both men and perhaps most especially to women. But the question is, what do you do about it? Now, in my party, we are doing, you know, a lot of mentoring and training and financial support and other forms of support to get women elected in seats where we have a chance of having Liberal Democrat MPs elected. But I've come to my own personal views: if the Liberal Democrats don't crack this problem at the next election in May, then we should consider doing something that other parties have done, which is maybe for a temporary period of time, reserving certain positions or, you know, positions for certain candidates for women and other candidates from other underrepresented groups, because...
So white males need not apply?
Well, look, it's a controversial thing. It always quite rightly provokes a lot of debate, particularly in a Liberal party, because people say, ah, well, you know, isn't the danger that smacks of tokenism and so on? But we cannot carry on purporting to represent modern Britain if modern Britain is not represented in us. So, you know, we're doing everything to... So, for instance, of the 11 Liberal Democrat MPs standing down, the vast majority of candidates standing to replace them are women or candidates from black minority ethnic backgrounds and others.
Right.
But if that doesn't work, I'm saying, I certainly don't think...
So my dream of representing Smethwick for the Lib Dems is just lying in shatters now. It's never going to happen,
you could call yourself Nicola Ferrari.
Well, I could do that. Now, before I let you go, have you got a minute? Have you seen this special spoof version of Uptown Funk released? Well, we can't show you the pictures, but here's the audio. Nick Clegg doing Bruno Mars, or is it the other way round?
This hits everyone in our country. We've achieved great things. The Conservatives don't do it. Labour don't do it. In 2020. What sort of Britain?
Great singing voice.
Hard-working and welcome. So let me be clear. Britain, and we are too hot. Lib Dems working for a stronger economy. Too hot. Lib Dems working for a fairer society. Too hot. Lib Dems say name.
Do you go catch on?
I doubt it. You can see it on lbc.co.uk. Yes, you can see it on lbc.co.uk. Lots of jump cuts of Mr. Clegg. A quick verdict on the audio, at least.
I think the singing voices, obviously, just in top-notch form.
Right, good luck with the bruising battle you face in the schoolrooms.
Thank you very much.
Sheffield from the 11-year-olds. That was cool, Clegg. We welcome you back, of course, here on LBC. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is
Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
It's in Eccleshall.
In a town hall or community hall or something.
It's in a church hall.
Church hall, right, okay.
And you're perfectly free to come to that.
I appreciate you've got security considerations.
No, of course. Why did you come to Banner Cross? Why did you come to Banner Cross this evening where everybody else from... Are you a constituent of mine, Chris?
I am.
Why don't you come to Banner Cross?
I'm not on the list, I won't get in.
Of course you can come if you want to come this evening.
I know, I've been to your debates. You have to apply in advance and be on the list.
What's wrong with
passport to show who you are? This isn't a public debate in any real sense of the word. And the other candidates aren't there. You're not debating with the other candidates. You're answering questions from a hand-picked audience, effectively.
No, I'm not, Chris. This is just ludicrous. This is such a sort of silly thing to say. I hold, in a way, by the way, that most MPs don't, open question and answer sessions, and anyone can come along if they want. Of course, they have to apply, so we know...
Why are you doing it in a school?
What?
Why are you doing it in a school?
I don't know. It's Sheffield. The Sheffield Star decided
to do
that.
Well, why didn't you say, yes, can I do one in the works canteen of the Sheffield bus garage or whatever it might be called?
Why is it the only one he's agreed to do? It's because of the way the Sheffield Star have organised it.
Well, Chris, listen, you've obviously got a bit of an axe to grind, and I'm never going to satisfy you. You come along again to Banner Cross this evening. I can guarantee you that no other candidate in Sheffield Hallam has made themselves as readily available as I have to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of my constituencies, year in, year out now for the last decade. You're clearly a bit grumpy about the way that Sheffield staff organise this. I can't help you with that.
He's in the pub and coffee mornings and invites people by leaflets to the door. Anybody can tell.
Chris, for all I know, you might be a Labour activist or member.
Are Are you a UKIP campaigner or something, Chris?
No, he'll be
hardly a UKIP campaigner.
You're a Labour campaigner.
I am a constituent. I have a vote. I also have a right to see my MP.
Yes.
Asking to be elected. And
so why don't you come along to Bannercross this evening?
Because you won't be debating with the other candidates, and it's not the same thing.
Well, Chris, I don't think I'm ever going to satisfy you, so...
All right, Chris. Can I ask which way you intend to vote? You don't have to answer this, but which way you intend to vote?
At the moment, not for Mr. Clegg.
All right, well, there's
a surprise. There's a surprise.
But you could always be one back. We move on to other matters, Mr. Clegg.
Mike in Cheshunt. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Mr. Clegg. Nice to talk to you for the last time. The House of Lords Economic Affairs Select Committee, the Public Accounts Select Committee, supported by the National Audit Office, and public opinion, all tell you the case for HS2 has not been made. Now, to ignore this overwhelming evidence is at best arrogant, Mr. Clegg. Isn't it time for the government to scrap this project now and stop wasting more of the taxpayers' money that, frankly, could be better spent on the NHS and other important issues?
Mike, no, I don't agree. And of course, I hear what you say about the committee from the House of Lords today about HS2. But other reports, of course, have come out with very different conclusions. So the very authoritative reports by David Higgins came to quite a different conclusion and said that the congestion and overcrowding and overburdening, if you like, of our current railway infrastructure requires a long-term solution where we really unblock the main arteries of our rail transport network. And HS2 is a very, very kind of smart way of doing that, because it means that we can get people up and down the kind of north-south spine of the country much more quickly, with far greater capacity than we presently have, so that we don't do what we've been doing for the last several decades, is a very expensive sort of patch and mend job where we kind of, you know, patch up this bit of the railway network, patch up that bit of the railway network, but don't really provide the long-term capacity to allow millions and millions of people to travel freely across the country in the future. And I mean, obviously, as a Sheffield MP, I feel particularly strongly that it is a good thing to link the north and the south of the country more effectively together. But I just also think we need to learn, in a sense, from our predecessors, who, you know, in the Victorian era built ambitious infrastructure to last. In fact, it was so ambitious and it lasted so well, we're still using our Victorian infrastructure. And I think rather than just sort of patching and mending it, we should actually revamp our infrastructure in a big way.
Mr. Clegg, nobody who is against this £50 billion project is suggesting we do not improve our rail infrastructure. Yes, we must for future generations. What people are saying is the cost of 250-mile-an-hour trains is astronomical. It cannot be justified. And, yes, you mentioned David Higgins. Well, he's the chairman of HS2. I would hardly expect him to come out and say, actually, I don't agree with HS2. Mm. We're paying this man £750,000 a year. When I say we, I mean the taxpayer. Mm. Of course he's in favour of HS2. Mm. But why is it you and Mr. Cameron and your MPs and colleagues refuse to believe these committees, which have, the respect of the public? You just told a previous caller, I believe, the first chap that called in, you told him there'd been an independent report, and you more or less told him that he should accept that. Well, you don't practice what you preach, because there's been plenty of independent reports from very respected House of Commons and House of Lords committees, but you choose to ignore them.
No, look, I perfectly accept this is a contested issue. I don't accept that all the monopoly of wisdom is on the side of those who criticise HS2. I also I think it's just an observable fact that as a country, certainly compared to other countries around the world who've invested huge amounts of money in high-speed rail and have done so many, many years ago and have benefited from it very considerably, we are very much a laggard. And I think there's a bit of a pattern in Britain for us to kind of try and improve our infrastructure in a sort of higgledy-piggledy way, on the cheap, a little bit of improvement here, a little bit of improvement there. HS2 is an opportunity to do something transformative, which will stand the test of time for many, many generations, because it will provide extra capacity on our very, very overburdened railway network for a very, very long period of time. And and I think there is, you know, there's very credible evidence, not just from Higgins but from others, to show that that is a sensible thing to do. And it doesn't crowd out, this is the point I would make to you, though, it doesn't crowd out investment in ongoing investment, maintenance and other forms of improvement to the road and rail network at the same time. And some of the suggestions made that it gobbles up all the available money simply is not correct.
Can I ask a couple of questions? How wise of it was it of the Prime Minister to say that he would not seek to fight another general election as Prime Minister, should he be successful in this one next in May?
Ask him. I mean, he's
well, I'm asking you. He's already commented. Well, I tell you what, would you seek to fight the election after this as leader of the Liberal Democrats?
Listen, I'd happily settle for a couple of terms as Prime Minister. That's fine.
No, as leader of the Liberal Democrats, I said.
Oh, no, I look...
After this general election...
Of course I intend to see through the next term. And look, then let's just take one term at a time, but...
So you might go as well in what? 5 years' time.
No, I don't, let's not get into this parlour game. Ah, you didn't rule this out.
Are you happy to commit to...
Am I going to carry on to 2070?
Yes.
2070, yes, there you go. Guarantee
you're happy to go all the way.
2170, why not? Let's go.
Very concerned about it. The Prime Minister took his children into the last Prime Minister's question. Yes. Yes. Did you bring your children in?
To Prime Minister's questions?
Yeah, to look from the gallery.
No.
Why not? Why would he do that and you didn't do that? Why wouldn't they want to
witness it? For a start, he was speaking at Prime Minister's questions and I wasn't.
But they'd like to see their dad do that, wouldn't they?
It had literally never occurred to me to bring my children to watch that ludicrous spectacle in Prime Minister's questions yesterday. But listen, but he's doing the talking along with Ed Miliband. I'm not, so he's perfectly entitled to ask his kids along.
Has James Landale asked to come to your kitchen?
No, I've done a piece with James. We drunk a pint outside a country pub.
Oh, that's been broadcast,
yes.
Is it?
You
oh,
missed it.
No, I'm afraid I missed that.
Oh,
yeah.
Right,
yeah. Would you ever walk to school with your children the way Ed Miliband does, being filmed by ITV?
Miriam and I have always been very adamant that we will talk, as I've regularly done here, with great pride and love and affection. I'm besotted by my children. I'll do that all day long if invited to do so, but we never ever have our children on public display, just because we don't. I mean, look, and I'm not, you know, David Cameron and Ed Miliband, they should make their own decisions, as every parent is entitled to, but I think my children are entitled to the kind of privacy of an innocent childhood, and that's, I felt very strongly about that as long as I've been in politics.
This is the last week, really, of the coalition before you all go off and fight.
Yes, we had our last cabinet day yesterday.
When's the party and can I come?
No, you can't come but because there isn't a party.
There's no party to celebrate what you've achieved?
No, we're not going to go test strips.
Some Twizzlers and some Lambrusco.
We exchanged beer and crisps.
Did you?
Yeah.
When was that?
On Tuesday. I gave a packet of Yorkshire crisps to all the cabinet, yeah.
Very nice. Yeah. Special
Henderson's.
There we are. Get the name
Crisps
out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, who was it? Chris from Sheffield.
No, yeah. Henderson Yorkshire Chris was praising. Right. Yeah. And what did you get back? Did anybody give you anything?
David Cameron produced a bottle of beer with a sort of picture of the coalition on it for everybody. So it's beer and crisps.
It's living the dream there, isn't it?
Yeah,
we move on.
Deborah and Enfield.
Right.
Hello, Deborah.
Harold Wilson's days. Deborah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Mr. Clegg. I was just wondering if I can ask you why neither yourself or any of the party leaders actually came out and condemned the attack on Mr. Farage and his family at the weekend?
I did, actually.
Really?
Yes, I did. I think I couldn't agree with you more, Deb. I thought it was absolutely appalling. I mean, of course I disagree with Nigel Farage, but to... And this is what I read as well, like you, Deb. But I was quite angered on his behalf that his children apparently were very upset and quite
shaken.
Well,
they ran off and hid.
Yeah, and my heart goes out to them because, you know, they're children and they don't deserve to be sort of, you know, brought into the kind of crosshairs of people's protests against Nigel Farage. So I tweeted my support for him and his family because I think he has every right as a dad to have lunch unmolested with his own kids.
Straight answer to a straight question, or as the Prime Minister put it, straight question to a straight answer, is about as he said yesterday, it's his moment of glory. He just blasted the ball over the net, but let's not be picky. We move on.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Good. One question, a quick question. If you, if David Cameron offered you the chance of becoming Prime Minister, would you take it? And what changes would you make?
What changes would I make? I think I'd insist that I've got on with my job as Mayor of London. That's what I'd do.
Oh, now don't.
Now come on,
the question, Mr. Mayor.
I think
yesterday it was
Andy. Let me answer Andy and Dartford before you push in, Nick. I mean, you're perfectly entitled. You can come in a minute.
That's very kind of you.
Andy and Dartford's asking me what changes I'd make if I were Prime Minister. Well, my job, Andy, is Mayor of London, and I've got to get on and make more changes in London. And I've got more than a year to serve as in that office. It's a huge privilege. It's an incredibly difficult job, but it's going outstandingly well for London. And where today Mike Brown is announcing huge progress on the tube, reductions in delays, increases in efficiency, carrying more people than ever before.
How is it going to do that?
This week, we're by putting in the signalling that we've...
How is it going to carry more people than ever before?
Basically, by doing what we've done on things like the Victoria Line, where we're up to 34 trains an hour now. So you've got basically more than one every 2 minutes. And that massively increases your capacity. So if you put the signalling in, you pay, and people say, well, why are we paying all this stuff in fares? Well, that is the answer. It enables us to improve the network. So, Andy, you know, yes, I've got to get on and do a huge job for whatever it is, 15 months or so.
Yes.
And I intend to do that.
Right.
12 months, 30
now,
months.
Now, let's come back to the meat of what happened last night with the Prime Minister saying that he would not seek a third term before he's even won a second. How wise was he to say that?
By the way, before I come to that, I think I forgot to tell everybody, if they want to ask questions, they don't want to dodge these questions. If they want to ask questions, dial 0345... Shush, calm down. Dial 0345... Yes, I'm in charge of this show, and I just want people who might not have got this number 0345 60 60 973 to get through to me or Nick. Now, Nick, what did you say? What did you say again?
I'd like you to comment on the wisdom or lack thereof with the Prime Minister saying he'd seek the third term.
Come on,
before he's even won a second. You've now had time to consider the answer fully before he has got a second.
No, actually, I think what David Cameron is saying is entirely, you know, banal and obvious, and David has already been leader of the Conservative Party. Dave has been leader of the Conservative Party for 10 years, and he's done an outstanding job. What he's saying now is that he wants to serve through till 2020, and that is frankly what we need him to do. The country needs it. We need to get on with entrenching an economic recovery that very strong, but not totally secure.
Mr. Mayor, he's
it
not
would
won
be
the second
it would
term,
be endangered then. By a Labour government.
Right.
And 5 years, five more years is what this country needs. That is what the Prime Minister is offering to serve. And I think that's fantastic. And frankly, you know, I'm not entirely certain I see what the story is. He was asked a straight question. Are you going to serve try and run a third term like Mrs. Thatcher or Tony Blair or whoever? And he said no. Because he thinks that 10 years at the top of British politics is an incredibly long time.
Yet.
And well, he was
rather presumptive, isn't it?
No, it's not at all. I think I don't understand at all. All this stuff about how it's taking people. On the contrary, what he's talking about, he was asked a question about a third term. He is fighting flat out, as we all are, to win a second term. That is absolutely vital. And we have a long-term economic plan for the economy, for the country, and it's only by getting David Cameron back into government that we'll deliver it. So you know, to say he's arrogant or presumptuous and to rule out a third term seems to be totally bizarre. I mean, he's being, I think, rather humble and rather straightforward and telling it like it is.
Is he right when he says that all Prime Ministers go mad?
Well, I don't know about that. I
mean, well, you're seven of you.
But I think what he's saying is that he doesn't intend to
do all
that.
Prime Ministers go mad?
I don't think so necessarily. I don't think that the Prime Minister is mad. I think he's showing eminent sanity and reasonableness.
But he said that they all go mad eventually.
And by the way, you know, what is so extraordinary about this, saying you're not going to serve another... I think both my illustrious Labour predecessor and myself have been very clear with Electoral London, we weren't going to serve more than one more term. You know, this is no big deal. Shall we go? Shall we go to...
For now, yes.
Well, if you can come back if you like.
Oh, my.
By the way, where's my... Is that my coffee over there?
No, I didn't know you knew what it was.
Can we go to...
How do you take your coffee?
Keith in Stoke Newington.
No, that's mine. You can drink it if you want to.
Before we get to the coffee, let's go to Keith in Stoke Newington, please. Right. Thank you.
Yes, good morning, gents. The question is, on the basis that Henry VIII separated church and state 500 years ago... And by the introduction of Sharia law, you wiped out 500 years of this development of the English-speaking people, and the instance of young Muslim people running off to IS, etc., etc. What do you think? How can you protect London and people from this Islamic inroads into our city?
Well, I'm totally against having any type of Sharia system at all, Keith. And or Sharia system running in parallel with UK justice, that is unacceptable to me.
Even in civil courts?
Absolutely not. We have a system that everybody must be equal under the law, and everybody must obey the same law. And that is absolutely cast. I take grave exception to some of the support that I see sometimes, and from clerics in the Church of England, Keith, who come out in favour of this, I've noticed, have said, we should be a little bit indulgent of this. And I think, actually, you speak about Henry VIII, but it's an interesting fact that we have some clerical fossils still in our legislature. Don't forget, we have bishops sitting by right in the upper house. And you may want to reflect on that, Keith. The separation of church and state is not perhaps as thoroughgoing in this country as you might like to think.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the point. But the reason that happened was because, like Islam, Catholicism was politically... a political control of the law, wasn't it? So the idea of bringing the bishops in was Protestant was to stop the political control and freedom of thought, basically, which is why we have Christians in the church, unfortunately. Well, I don't know if that's a good idea or not.
Well, it's very... You can't really start having Christians in the church. I mean, that's where you'd expect to find them, just as you expect, generally speaking, to find Russians in Russia or bears in woods and so on. But you know, I think the point is, Keith, I think you're making a really sound point, which is that the... idea of a parallel system of law, a parallel judicature, a people making the laws according to a different system is absolutely unacceptable. It's alien to our traditions. I won't have it in London, and I'm worried sometimes by the faint bat squeaks of support that I hear for that idea, even from clerics in the Church of England.
So even civil cases. You don't want Sharia law?
No, I don't.
So the Beth Din will have to go as well?
Yes, I absolutely. Source for the goose is source for the gander. Source for the
What's
goose is source
with
for
Jewish
the gander.
Jewish people getting their marriages dissolved through the Beth Din?
Well, look, because they can do that, but it's got to be done in parallel with... It's got to be done
simultaneously. So we can have the Beth Din? You just said it had to go?
It's got to be done in accordance...
Why can't a Muslim woman have her divorce finalised through a Sharia... civil case.
It cannot substitute for UK civil proceedings.
Why can't
you can consecrate a union in church as well as in a civil way. So you've got to make sure that it doesn't substitute.
Why can't a Muslim couple have their divorce handled in a Sharia court?
They can, but they
you just said we couldn't
they,
have.
Yes,
I specifically asked.
But they cannot replace the civil proceedings. So whatever happens, if they want to have some ceremonial proceeding according to religious ritual or whatever, that is fine. But it's got the actual implementation of the law has got to be done in UK, in British courts, and according to British law, agreed by Parliament.
All right.
Agreed by Parliament. That is where the law emanates from. The law emanates in the end from the people, voting MPs who enact the statutes that we all obey, and that gives this country a vital equality.
Right, have a sip of coffee as I just get into the next.
Can we get a mic? We're
going to. I thought you'd like some coffee. Let's ask Mike to hold one second. Have a sip of coffee.
Right.
I'm just going to get you to comment on this. You and I have talked quite a lot about the Emirates airline. Why was it closed for a week?
Well, it's closed at the moment because I think it's undergoing regular maintenance. But I'm delighted, as ever, that you choose to bat on this wicket that is so completely unfavourable.
Between
you.
July 2012 and December 2014, 354 closures.
Yeah, they're very brief closures caused
Well, a closure is a closure.
Very brief closures caused by high winds, which are an atmospheric phenomenon that you'd expect in that part of London, where there's the wind comes down the river, and actually it runs the overwhelming majority of
passaging numbers have dropped significantly since 2012, this year averaging 4,285 per day.
Passenger numbers are rising.
No, they're falling to 4,285 per day.
The Emirates Airline, and I want to congratulate Danny Price and all the team who run the Emirates Airline, because they are doing an outstanding job. Do you know, Nick, it has now taken 5 million passengers. There are people travelling it throughout the day for work, for pleasure. And it's a fantastic...
You've enjoyed it. Yes, there's a bit of fun.
How can you possibly commute if
this damn thing's closed?
It is functioning the vast majority of the time. Of course, there are occasional closures. Because
occasional?
Of that you're talking about very short periods of time when we have high winds.
It's been closed for a week.
That's for maintenance.
Okay? Well, it's high winds, it's maintenance, the van broke down. There's so many reasons why the damn thing keeps closing.
I'm delighted that we're maintaining something
that's never used.
This is the only piece of transport. It's used more. You talk such nonsense, and you're so negative, and you're so miserable. You remind me of some sort of lefty these days. What's gone wrong with you? It's the most brilliant.
That's the worst insult.
It's the most brilliant thing, actually.
So when you signed off on it, we knew it would close this off.
It's barely ever closed.
It's only 354
closures. Yeah, but for very short periods
months.
Of time, people
it's
love this
It's closed for a week.
Oh, well, listen, I'm delighted that you feel such a desire to get up on it the whole time, and you're quite right. Lots of people do. It's carried 5 million people. It's carrying more and more people. And by the way, before we go to Mike and Crawley, since you raised this thing, I'm just going to remind you that it's the only piece of transport infrastructure in this city that actually already covers its revenue cost.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Let's go to the first caller, and the first caller is Philip in Finchley. Hello, Philip.
Good morning, Nick Blake. How are you doing?
I'm right. How are you?
Oh, well, not. Could be better, could be worse.
Yeah, good.
So, Mr. Craig, the reason I've given the LBC a call today is because of the contaminated blood condition.
Yes.
Okay, I was up in Scotland yesterday, and I can tell you that we're absolutely disgusted. £12 million of taxpayers' money was spent on that.
And it was on the Penrose report.
On the Penrose report. Mm. And it was a whitewash. I think the only thing that Lord Penrose suggested, or recommended, shall I say, was that everybody in Scotland that had a blood transfusion between X and X dates should be tested for hepatitis C. Mm. What a complete waste of taxpayers' money. Mm. How many more scandals, Mr. Craig, need to be revealed before the governments, plural, stand up and put an end to 30 years of campaigning? Mr. Clegg, I ask you, my dad, my uncle, and my uncle were all affected by this. I had to watch, Mr. Clegg, last year, July, with my dad, and he went into King's College Hospital, had a liver transplant because of this disaster. Nothing that was his fault. Yeah. And, Mr. Clegg, I asked you, in your manifesto in 2010, you pledged to sort this out. Yet another broken promise from our governments. I am disgusted to call myself British.
Right. Well, Philip, I obviously can hear your fury, and I'm acutely aware. I saw the pictures myself of the campaigners setting fire to the Penrose report, and it's impossible for me to imagine the sense of injustice and hurt and anger and sort of unresolved justice that the families of those who had their blood infected in this way must feel. But forgive me, can I just ask you, Philip, what was it that you had hoped the Penrose report would recommend or would conclude?
I would like the Penrose report to put blame because this was no accident, Mr. Clegg. You know where the blood products come from. You know the history of this condition. I'm sure you do. If you don't, I'll be extremely surprised. You know that these were blood products.
Just to explain to my listeners, this is my job. It's on a previous watch. It has to be said many, many years ago. Unfortunately, it was the fact that contaminated blood, much of it bought from the US and had been given by prostitutes who were infected with HIV and other conditions, was bought and was used by. But this time, it wasn't a devolved NHS. It was a UK NHS, and that's why we have the problem that we have, Philip. I know the Deep Deputy Prime Minister knows that. That's just to explain to listeners. Philip, back to you.
Thank you very much. Yes. The blood products, fully aware where they come from. What I hope the inquiry would have done, Mr. Clegg, there used to be, or there is, free networks of financial support. These people have never been given financial support, or sorry, I rephrase that, have never been given compensation. Yeah. Never, ever, ever. And if that's a misconception, then that needs to be changed.
Yeah. Now, there has been talk, and there have been some sorts of payments of compensation in Southern Ireland, but not in the UK.
There has, and as the Prime Minister said yesterday in the House of Commons, obviously first, quite rightly, if you like, issuing an apology on behalf of everybody who has been failed for the hurt that they have endured. But the reason I asked you, Philip, about what you want the report, because, of course, in a sense, the report was independent. It was produced by Penrose. As a government, I like to think we've done the only thing we could do, which is the right thing, which is to...
But Mr. Clegg, the English government have point-blank refused for 30 years an inquiry. This was not an inquiry of the English government's making. This was an inquiry of the Scottish government's making. Yet again, it was pushed under the carpet by everybody in Westminster. Nobody in Westminster wanted to know. Well, we as campaigners have been fighting to get an inquiry, but yet again, we've been denied, been told... I think the words were, there's everything that needs to be known in the public domain. Well, I think there's not. I think this cover-up, as most cover-ups do, goes very, very deep. Mr. Clegg, I have to ask you, how many more cover-ups? Now we've got the paedophilia
I'm of course I cannot imagine what you've gone through, Philip, and you've just talked very movingly about your dad, and so I know you're not going to find any what I say in a sense is going to in any way assuage your sense of anger about all of this, but you know the facts are that the Penrose report did look into the cases of the Scottish victims over that span of time from 1970 through to I think the early 1990s, and it came up with the conclusions it did. It wasn't written by any politician. It wasn't written by the government. It's just been published. We have said as a government, clearly the next parliament needs to act on that report, act on those recommendations and provide proper compensation. And we've said already, yesterday, that £25 million is being made immediately available on top of the money that's already been made available. You've been very, very clear that none of that is satisfactory to you, but... I'm not going to pretend to you that I can sort of imagine easily that someone's just going to suddenly rewrite a report that's been produced independently. I think that is unlikely, to be honest.
All right, Philip, listen, commiserations, condolences, very tough time for you. We will keep across that and see what other developments the campaigners are saying. This is no means the end of the campaign. Also, I think there's more life in that story. We move on to other matters.
Charles in Maidstone. Charles?
Oh, good morning, Deputy Prime Minister. Good morning. Just a question, really. I think opinion polls are suggesting that your party is going to lose a lot of seats in the coming election. And I just wonder if you feel somehow disappointed or maybe even angry about that, because I think the government, you know, the country, a lot of people, I think, would feel the country's in a slightly better place than it was 5 years ago. And
just a bit.
Your party doesn't seem to be getting any of the credit for that.
Forgive me, Charles, I've got a bit of a cough. No, of course I don't feel... I mean, for starters, I actually think, Charles, we're going to do a lot better than people predict. For the very simple reason, by the way, that a sort of snapshot opinion poll over the whole of the country doesn't really pick up what's happening in the, you know, 10% or so parts of the country where Liberal Democrat campaigners are out, you know, putting leaflets through doors and knocking on doors and talking to people and so on. And where we get our, the Liberal Democrats, that is, where we get our side of the story across, which, as you implied, Charles, I think is a good story because, you know, the country was on the brink back in 2010, and without us stepping up to the plate bravely and pluckily, in my view, we wouldn't now have the economic recovery and we wouldn't have a whole range of other things which are of real tangible benefit to people. Tax cuts, more apprenticeships, better pensions, the pupil premium, healthy meals at lunchtime for kids at primary school, and so on and so forth. And look, so let's see what happens on May the 7th. But my hope is that where people get to hear our side of the story, and they do from us directly in those areas where we have a presence on the ground, actually will do much, much better than people anticipate.
Quick response from you, Charles.
Well, yeah, I'd just be interested. I'm interested to know really why the story isn't getting across from your side more than it is. I think people still hold in against you the tuition fees.
Sure.
Thing. I think, and I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think you could be expected to deliver on everything. After all, you weren't going into a government on your own. So,
no.
But I just think that it seems maybe a little unfair.
Charles, I think one of the reasons, of course, is that we live in a political culture which is accustomed to the idea of the two, you know, larger parties playing sort of Buggins' turn with the British government. So it's the red team and it's the blue team, it's the red team, and they've got their big vested interests. The trade unions fund the Labour Party, you've got the big money funding the Tories, you've got all of their supporters in the press lined up on one side of the fence or the other, and suddenly the yellow team comes along and gets his foot in the door, and they hate it. Both sides absolutely hate it. And so the red team and the blue team spend the last half decade yelling at us furiously from right and left. And so obviously we get yelled at a lot. And that, you know, and I take that with as good humour and good grace as I can.
Is that at work or at home?
What? At work. And to be serious, Charles, of course that means that some of our achievements, which we're very, very proud of, you know, the tax cuts, getting the economy sorted out, pushing for more money in school for kids from the most disadvantaged backgrounds, and so on and so forth, gets a bit drowned out by that endless kind of yelling from right and left. But I don't spend much time whinging about it, or certainly not feeling angry or aggrieved about it. That's just the way life is. I'm a pragmatic politician. What I would say to you, Charles, however, is what I can control, or what I can do, is, as I will be, for instance, later today, sort of knocking on doors in my own constituency, yeah, and telling my own side of the story. And where Liberal Democrats do that, I think we do get a fair hearing and a good hearing.
All right. In fact, I think that's where we might be going next.
Chris in Sheffield. Yeah, hello,
there,
Chris. Hello.
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 Good morning.
Morning.
Greg. My question is really about your not being in Sheffield often enough, and certainly not going to Sheffield to stand in front of your constituents and debate with your opponents.
I'm doing it today.
In a hustings. Well, you're not doing it in front of your constituents, Mr. Clay. You're doing it in front of an invited audience of school children. Now, this isn't really what a hustings debate is about, is it? I'm more concerned about your hypocrisy in criticising Mr. Cameron for ducking the debates when you're doing exactly the same thing yourself.
What a silly thing to say, Chris! Heaven's sake, there's a hustings today organised by our great local newspaper, the Sheffield Star, and they decide how to organise it. Now you're
I'm going to support Chris here because it says it will be held in front of a small invited audience, invited by.
But they've decided to do that.
Take place at a secret location.
No, it's not.
I don't want to compromise your security. Can you tell me where it is?
Well, it's at the school.
Well, presumably there's more than one.
Yes, I know there's one, but I mean, look, I'm...
So my caller, Chris, is right.
Yes.
It's children. But you're debating children.
Hang on, this is...
Not that I've got anything against Sheffield
but
children.
Chris, why don't you pick up the phone and speak to the local newspaper about the reasons why they've decided to organise their hustings? I'm invited...
I'm on the phone to you, Mr. Clegg, asking you why this is the only debate, and it's not a true debate, that you're prepared to participate in your own constituency.
But Chris, as you clearly don't know, as someone, I have represented Sheffield Hallam and done so very happily, and it's one of the greatest privileges of my political life for the last 10 years. And week in, week out, I'm out and about in Sheffield. In fact, this very evening, after I do these hustings, I'm holding a public question and answer session, as I do week in, week out, where hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, over the last...
May we know where that is?
It's in, where is it? It's in Eccles Hall.
In the town hall or community hall or something.
It's in a church hall.
Church hall, right, okay.
And you're perfectly free to come to that.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
A new home.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Well, it would appear that Top Gear is possibly set to stall. It is expected to continue on the BBC, although it will at some point today be announced that Jeremy Clarkson will be leaving the programme. It is reported that the announcement will come from DG Lord Hall. He'll go from the show after an internal investigation has concluded he did assault Top Gear producer Oisin Tyman. By the way, not just any assault. For 20 minutes, Clarkson reportedly verbally harangued Tyman before physically attacking him for at least 30 seconds. This, according to some extraordinarily good journalistic work by the Daily Telegraph, has been a part of a report compiled by the BBC Scotland chief Ken Macquarie and submitted to his bosses at the weekend. Clarkson has a 7-figure contract with the BBC. He was suspended earlier this month. Worth reminding you, he reported himself to his bosses over the incident. How have people reacted? Well, more than 1 million people have signed an online petition to reinstate him. Even Prime Minister David Cameron, known to be a friend and also a neighbour of Clarkson's, weighed into the row, describing him as a huge talent and hoped that it could all be resolved. How much will the show miss him? How much will the BBC miss him? Well, you're going to miss jokes such as this from 2008.
Because this is a hard job, and I'm not just saying this to win favour with lorry drivers, it's a hard job. Change gear, change gear, change gear, check your mirrors, murder a prostitute, change gear, murder, check your... That's a lot of effort in a day.
Wasn't just restricted to the show either. He could make jokes elsewhere like this in 2009.
In England, we have this one-eyed Scottish idiot. I've said that now.
You said that out loud as well, yeah, yeah.
Well, the one-eyed Scottish man, he keeps telling us everything's fine and he's saved the world. And we know he's lying.
His co-hosts, Richard Hammond and James May, would sometimes join in. 2010.
Just imagine waking up and remembering you're Mexican.
That'd be brilliant. It'd be brilliant because you could just go straight back to sleep again.
He'd either go on other BBC shows. 2011, The One Show.
I'd have them all shot. I would take them outside and execute them in front of their families. I mean, how dare they go on strike when they've got these gilt-edged pensions that are going to be guaranteed while the rest of us have to work for a living?
Talking about public sector striking workers there. 2013, and this is when perhaps it started to get a bit hot. This is when it is reported that Danny Cohen, who's the head of BBC Television, started to take against Mr. Clarkson. This is the use of the N-word.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. So when he squeals, let him go, eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
It just doesn't appear to learn. Apologies for the remark you're going to hear now. This is from 2014.
That is a proud moment. But there's a slope on it.
Yes, referring, of course, to an Asian person. Again, apologies if you were offended by that. Will the show be the same without him? What does it say about the modern BBC? Coping, managing, looking after talent. I know it is ridiculous. This man earns an extraordinary salary, and it would appear he couldn't have a steak meal. You'll be thinking, if you're a bus driver, if you're a nurse, if you're a travelling salesman or woman right now stuck on the M25, what the? But that appears to be the way it is. Tim Luckhurst is head of the Centre for Journalism at the University of Kent. He's a former newspaper editor and BBC boss. What's it like managing talent, Tim Luckhurst? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Well, it's difficult, and every editor at the BBC, throughout broadcasting, in newspapers, and, let's face it, directors in film know that managing talent is difficult. And big stars can behave atrociously. And I suggest that if some Hollywood studios sacked them for behaving like prima donnas, we'd all be sorry.
What's happening within the BBC here? It has been reported, Professor, that Danny Cohen, who's the TV boss, wanted him out. Lord Hall, who is the DG, wanted him to stay. Whose one do you imagine?
Well, I don't know who's won. If the reports in the papers this morning are right, then Mr. Cohen has. But I think the big point is that the BBC's handling of this allegation has been painfully slow and bureaucratic, and that by being painfully slow and bureaucratic, it's maximised the pain caused to Mr. Clarkson, to his alleged victim, to viewers of Top Gear, to the licence payer, and to the BBC. It should have been possible to talk to all of those concerned in this incident within 24 hours, and then to reach a conclusion. As ever in the BBC, bureaucracy has replaced common sense, managerial competence has been forced to take second place to a bureaucratic process which has often replaced reason, and the politics of arguments between very senior BBC managers have played their part in this. I think it's really been handled abysmally.
If it is true that he's on his way, what will it mean for the BBC and indeed for the show in your view, Professor?
Top Gear is one of the BBC's most successful shows. Let's remember a few things about it. First of all, it appeals to many people in this country specifically because Jeremy Clarkson does behave in an outrageous and provocative manner. If the BBC didn't like that, it has spent a very, very long time tolerating, supporting and promoting it, and giving Top Gear a huge budget to make fantastically entertaining television. The next point is, this sells around the world for a very, very substantial sum of money.
Tens of millions.
It's popular all over the place. And if the BBC needs to raise commercial revenue to support its licence fee income and to subsidise to a certain extent the production of programmes, and I believe it should, then Top Gear is a huge success story. Does it depend on its presenter lineup? Well, the BBC will always argue that it is bigger than any individual, and there's an element of truth in this, but Top Gear is very much dependent upon a very entertaining presenter lineup, and I think it'll be difficult to replace the chemistry which exists between Jeremy Clarkson, James May and Richard Hammond. It'll be a very, very hard act to follow.
Always good speaking with you, Tim. Thanks. Professor Tim Luckhurst, Head of Centre for Journalism at the University of Kent, former BBC boss and indeed newspaper editor as well. Well, let's turn now to Chris Goffey. Chris is a motoring journalist and was a presenter of Top Gear. Chris, what did Jeremy Clarkson bring to the show?
I suppose it'd be, well, entertainment, if you like. You know, don't forget Top Gear's been going for many, many years. It used to be a little half-hour programme out of Pebble Mill, and even in those days was very successful. You know, for a BBC Two half-hour programme, it used to pull in 6-7 million viewers, which... you know, used to rank us quite high. Well, you know, I think we were number two in the BBC Two stakes at that time. It had a number of presenters. It started with Angela Rippon. Noel Edmonds was on it. All sorts of people were on it. And it was never a team show. It was more one presenter would introduce the whole show on location, and then you'd have filmed reports from... Yeah. different people, which would be keyed in. I think it was more an information show, and we were a bit more technical, if you like, about the cars. We used to look at cars that everybody could buy and use on the road, and we used to comment on, you know, how family cars, sports cars, you know, high-performance cars performed. Yes. And what Jeremy and the team, and, well, it's not just Jeremy. I mean, don't forget, you know, it's the editor of the programme. Really shook the format up, made it a team show and made it an entertainment show, and a wildly successful one.
You will be aware in broadcasting, Chris, they always warn that no one presenter, no talent as it's known, should be bigger than the show. Is Clarkson bigger than Top Gear?
No, I don't think so. I think the show would go on. I mean, there's not much more to say than your previous guest, but... it'd be enormously difficult to replace.
Well, they're talking Chris Evans, Chris.
Well, I don't know. I keep reading things that Chris has ruled himself out from it. But,
oh, right.
Yeah, you know, somebody like Chris Evans could do it. You know, look at the you know, there's a lot of rock stars out there who are heavily into very fast cars and have a good persona. Perhaps they need somebody older and more sort of mature and looking back on the history of motoring a bit more.
Who are you thinking of, Chris? Chris Goffey, motoring journalist and former Top Gear presenter. Good to speak with you, Chris. Election in the air, and here's another pledge or promise. Labour saying they will bring down the number of people using food banks through a new five-point plan. Here to walk us through those 5 points, Rachel Reeve, Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, and she's a Labour MP, obviously. She's in Leeds West, joins me now. How would you do it, Rachel Reeves? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Well, first of all, we would cancel the bedroom tax. That would help people in London and across the country who are really struggling right now. But we also know that a lot of people who are going to food banks are going there because they're on zero-hour contracts or because they're on the minimum wage, and the minimum wage has failed to keep up with the rising cost of living with bills and rents. So we would increase the national minimum wage to at least £8 an hour and ban those exploitative zero-hour contracts that are causing so much pain to so many people.
OK. It has been reported that in some instances now they have middle-class people using these food banks. Is there any truth to these reports, Rachel Reeves?
There is truth that there are people in work going to food banks, but the main reason for people going to food banks is because of benefit delays and because of sanctions, and we've said that we would get a grip of those benefit delays, including job seekers allowance, but particularly the disability benefits, personal independence payments, employment and support allowance, and also we would get a grip of the benefit sanctions regime. The job centres have clearly got targets for the number of people that they are sanctioning. We've seen a huge increase in the number of people being sanctioned, including pregnant women, people at risk of domestic violence, people with mental health issues, people who need a bit more protection rather than the rug being pulled from under their feet. So there are a number of ways we can reduce reliance on food banks, both for people in work and for those out of work.
Lastly, at the time of the introduction of the spare room subsidy, or bedroom tax as you call it, it was reported that there were up to possibly 1 million families in cramped conditions who needed housing stock to be freed up, and the idea was that people who had a spare room or a bedroom tax would be able to free up some of that stock. How will you combat that problem?
Well, what we've seen, the first report that the government published was that only 5% of people affected by the bedroom tax had been able to move because there simply aren't the smaller properties.
But that's the sort of other end of the equation. Is you're absolutely right. There was no single one-bedroom properties for them to go to, but we've still got the pressure from beneath, for want of a better expression.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we need to build more housing.
How will you do that?
Well, we've said that by the end of the Parliament, we'd be building an extra £200,000, 200,000 homes a year by freeing up the planning process, by using government land and building homes there. And that's got to be a mixture of housing, including that affordable housing
right.
that families need.
How's that all going to be paid for?
Going up.
How's all that housing to be paid for?
Well, some of it will be built by the private sector
right.
by freeing up the planning process, because at the moment there's huge blockages in the system, and that's why we've got at the moment the lowest level of house building in peacetime since the 1920s.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Try some of these numbers on. After four decades, 40 years, 2,000 deaths, a £6 million report, and yet it's nothing more than a whitewash. That's how families of thousands of patients given contaminated blood by the NHS have condemned an inquiry into the scandal. Patients were infected with HIV and hepatitis C after receiving blood supplies which had not been properly tested. Campaigners estimate more than 30,000 patients across the country were affected in the 70s and 80s, of whom 2,000 are no longer with us. Many had the rare blood disorder haemophilia and were given regular transfusions with a clotting agent known as Factor VIII, to stop internal bleeding. But this came from batches which had not been screened or treated for HIV and hepatitis C, a virus that infects the liver and can cause serious, sometimes fatal damage. The true scale of hepatitis C contracted via hospital transfusions has taken years to emerge because of the time it can take to start to experience the symptoms. Dame Anita Roddick caught it after a hospital blood transfusion following the birth of her daughter Sam in 1971. The Body Shop founder lived with the disease for more than 30 years before discovering she had it, by which time she was suffering from cirrhosis of the liver and she died aged 64 of a brain hemorrhage. The scandal was described as, quotes, the worst treatment disaster in the history of the NHS by Prime Minister David Cameron, who apologised on behalf of the government. But as I've said, for the families, it's simply not enough. You may recall we spoke with someone yesterday, May Beatridge from Kent, who joins me again. May, just for, it is possible that listeners are with me today who were not with me yesterday. Just briefly remind them, when did you get this condition and when did you have the transfusions and what has it done to you?
I had the transfusion around 1982.
Yeah.
And I was diagnosed in 2004. So it was busy in my body for a good few years before it was even discovered. So it had done quite a bit of damage before it was actually found.
And how has it left you? Just you were very explicit yesterday when we spoke, but just again for listeners who weren't with us yesterday, what has it done to you?
Well, it completely changed my life. I was forced to resign from what had been a very successful career. It was just not possible for me to operate at that level. It affects family. Your lifestyle, finances, just everything it affects. And you're also left with the stigma. And being that there's a lot of ignorance about hepatitis C, doesn't help your cause. It's you could, a lot of people say, well, what's that? Oh, I've heard about that. What is it? You know, so much ignorance. And it just doesn't help. So, bit of a disappointing day yesterday.
Well, that's what I want to come on to. Let's deal with this chronologically. Before you heard the publication yesterday morning, what were you hoping for?
Well, I was hoping that the Penrose was really seeing this.
That's the Penrose Inquiry, just to explain. That's the Penrose Inquiry up in Scotland that was published yesterday. Yeah, on you go. Yeah.
Considering it took 6 years, and as you said earlier, at a cost of £6 million, probably more, to be honest, it still, to me, didn't focus or state who was responsible for the purchase of blood products in the country. Surely buying blood from prisoners and prostitutes, even a layman would have known it was going to be a disaster waiting to happen.
And this is particularly prostitutes we discovered in the US that have, unfortunately, were infected with HIV. It's now been discovered. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I was hoping the report would really hit the nail on the head. Where did it go wrong? Who was responsible? And it clouded over the issues, I felt. I agree with the people in Scotland that it didn't explain. 6 years of £6 million. That £6 million could have gone in towards new treatments.
Yeah.
The treatments are so expensive, and that's something else. There's been no consideration about that research. So, yeah, very disappointed.
What now for you, May?
Well, probably battle on a bit, join forces, and we won't give up.
Right.
That's
what the campaigners are saying. Of course, although they were very, very, they felt it was a setback. They're saying they're not going to give up either.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't give up. Mm. It was a setback. It was, after yesterday. Well, I was, if I might say, I was a bit saddened that the sacking of Jeremy Clarkson got more TV airtime than the loss of 2,000 haemophiliacs that have died through contaminated blood.
Wow.
Sorry, Jeremy.
No, it's a good point you make.
And is the £25 million?
Yeah.
Is that going to go towards more useless outsources to manage this ridiculous amount of money and decide who gets it? And of course, they've got cost overhead, so that's some of the money gone. If that's going to happen, they've already got three organisations operating that are really of no benefit at all. That there's no, it's just a waste of funds.
And still no, lastly, as there was, and we talked briefly about this yesterday, as you will recall, in Ireland there was compensation made available. Where are we now? Some AIDS victims, I think, have been promised compensation, but much of it's not been forthcoming, I understand, May.
No. I think we spoke yesterday about regarding hepatitis C. The word compensation must never be mentioned.
No. It's a terrible situation, May. Good to talk to you for all the wrong reasons. Let's hope next time we speak there is a breakthrough. I hope your condition, I appreciate it's a very serious condition. I hope it can get as well as better as it can. Thank you. 843 calls on this. Adam in Canary Wharf. Hello, Adam. What can you tell me?
Hi. Good morning, Nick. This was a very famous scandal in America. It was actually driven by the American mafia.
Driven by the mafia, did you say?
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, you should remember it, to be honest, because there's a few people who were really involved in it.
I can't remember everything, in fairness.
Well, you are a journalist. Oh, never mind. There's only a woman journalist.
Not more than once, actually. Three, as it happens, plus a global.
Oh, well deserved as well.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, we're getting
much better than O'Brien. Yeah.
Well, okay, we're not here to do a sort of comparison of the team sheet, but just broadly remind my listeners of the main points of that story, if you would, Adam.
Basically, you could buy something. I think it was around about the $2 mark. You could buy a litre of blood,
right?
Something like that, or whatever, and it was going for $200. The only trouble was you weren't supposed to use it, and it was being thrown away. In America, the mafia controlled the rubbish dumping. They control all the waste clearance.
Oh, yeah.
So they were taking medical waste and reselling it. And then they realised if they set up their own clinics or went to prisons HIV and STDs clinics, they could actually offer to pay people direct. It was very lucrative. It went on for a long time.
That's incredible. Hey, I'm really grateful. It rings a vague bell, but I had nothing like the level of detail you brought to it, so I'm very, very grateful for that. Adam, look after yourself. Thank you. Come on. On earth has Benedict Cumberbatch been reading a specially written poem at the reinterment of the body of the late king? Well, he wouldn't be alive, would he, if they were putting his body in their neck? Keep thinking. Roy tells me Benedict Cumberbatch is Richard III's cousin 17 times removed. Oh, boy, that's all come in. I've really misspoken here. Patsy, Cumberbatch shares DNA with King Richard. The Americans love royal connections. It could make him loads of money. Another one here, Kenneth in Dartford. You should be aware Benedict Cumberbatch is a distant relative of Richard III. All right, OK, I didn't stand corrected. Possibly if the newsroom's listening, we might want to put that in because it does kind of explain why he suddenly pops up. It's really strange that he's suddenly there. They could have got Clarkson up there to do it. That would have been good. And now to read a poem about the late king, Jeremy Clarkson. Oh, and he just punches the Archbishop. No, maybe not. All right, on to other matters. We'll come to some of your emails, texts and tweets coming on as the two main parties, they're pretty much wrapping up affairs down at the House of Commons and then off they go. On to the major story of yesterday and still playing very big on the bulletins today, the tragedy of that aircraft crash in the Alps making its way, failing unfortunately to get from Barcelona to Dusseldorf. The recovery operation goes on in those French Alps. Kate Rousseau is a freelance journalist. We spoke with her yesterday. She joins me again today. Kate, can you give us an idea the scale of this recovery? How many personnel are being used?
Morning, Nick. Well, I've been told that there are along the lines of 300 police officers and 380 pompiers, which is roughly equivalent to firemen. I hope you can hear me. There's a helicopter just taken off above me. The gendarmes are very heavily involved as well. They organise the mountain rescue team here. So there is a massive operation going on. And as I speak to you, I'm actually in the site where they're parking the helicopters who are shuttling from here to the site, which is about 5 kilometres away. And I've just seen some people getting off a helicopter. I assume these are family members. I've been told that they will be taken to the site to see the wreckage if they choose to do so. And a lot of them have been coming over in the last day or two.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. Is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Ridiculous. It's unbelievable.
How much is it?
It's less than a fiver. I can't remember the exact price.
How much is a crossing?
We'll find out for you.
So you don't know, so it's a marvellous value. You have no idea how much it is.
It's marvellous value.
How much is it?
We'll find the number for you later on. We'll find the number for you later on.
We'll find the number.
Come on, we'll bring it to you. Well, so we can advertise the Emirates airline again.
We go to another caller now.
But in spite of, I think it's under a fiver as far as I can remember. We're going, and it depends if you have an Oyster card. It depends if you have Oyster or not. It's
£3.20 if you have an Oyster card.
Is that right?
£3.20 if you have
£3. There you go. £3.20 if you have an Oyster card. No wonder this is one of the most successful bits of transport infrastructure in the history of this city.
I think, look,
I'm glad that you're clamouring it for it to remain open
when it's
more
running.
Often.
Mm,
but
okay.
It is doing well. Can we go to Mike in Crawley,
of course,
please?
We can.
Mike.
Yes, good morning, Nick. Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, sir.
My question relates to equality before the law.
Yes.
Concerning recent allegations of sexual impropriety, we've seen many cases of people in the fields of media and entertainment being named when initially under investigation on the basis that possibly more witnesses would come forward. So why is it that politicians under similar investigation for alleged offences have not been identified? And would you agree with me that this anomaly seems to be the classic case of some animals being more equal than others, as George Orwell would have so succinctly put it?
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm not certain that is entirely the case, in the sense that I can think of quite a few politicians who've been named either posthumously or while they were alive, when actually nothing had been proved against them at all. I think of Alistair McAlpine, who was actually driven to an early grave by false allegations against him that were widely bruited and by not least on the BBC, as far as I can remember, Mike. So, I'm not certain that's entirely true. I think there is a genuine problem, which is that there is a need on the part of the police to try to make sure that they get the maximum possible evidence against an individual when they have reason to suspect a crime has been committed. And so sometimes, for the sake of the prosecution, for the sake of justice, they will put names out there. And that is what you have seen both for journalists and celebrities and also for politicians. So, unfortunately, it may sometimes turn out that the allegations are completely unfounded, in which case people go through an awful lot of misery for no purpose.
Mike?
Yeah, my response to that would be, I take your point with regard to certain aspects of it, but we recently saw one famous entertainer where was under investigation with helicopters in the air and the BBC sat outside. But routinely when I hear about politicians, I can hear about people who can't be named for legal reasons or whatever. And this is discounting, of course, the obvious danger of, in effect, substituting a hue and cry for witnesses rather than investigation and putting people before the court by the proper method.
But I'm not quite certain what you're saying here, Mike. Are you actually calling for these politicians to be named, or are you saying that nobody should be named?
Well, what I'm saying is that the current system that we have is where people are being named, and if people are being named, then they should be equally named.
Well, the point I'm making to you is that, as far as I can make out from the stories I've read, quite a lot of politicians have been named. Poor Leon Britton, I don't believe for a minute, was involved in anything like this. I really don't. I think it sounds like total nonsense to me. I remember he was a commissioner in Brussels when I was a reporter there. It strikes me as absolutely incredible that the allegations against him could be true. But, you know, his name's out there, being dragged through it. I haven't seen a shred of evidence to support it, frankly. I've mentioned
Alistair. So that's unfair, the way it's been introduced.
That's my instinct, you know. Maybe the police will produce something extraordinary and incriminating, but I really don't see it. I think, Mike, it's very difficult. I think the issue is, if you're trying to frame a prosecution, if you're trying to get the evidence that you need, then sometimes you will want to allow other potential victims to come forward, and that's what you've seen in the cases of Savile and others as they're called, and names have been put out there in order to encourage people to have the confidence to come forward. But clearly, in some cases, Mike, it will have a devastating effect on those who are innocent. So it is a very, very difficult balance. Can we go to Aldi in Belgravia?
Thanks, Mike. Yes, we will. Okay, go ahead, Aldi. Hi.
Yes, very good morning.
Good morning.
My first question, we have two questions for the to Boris Johnson.
Yes.
First is, please, your views on mansion tax to save the NHS, which I do not agree. And my second question is, I live in this country for more than 20 years. I hold an Italian passport.
How many years?
More than 20. Yeah.
For more than 20 years, I hold an Italian passport. I would love to vote for Prime Minister. Why can't I?
Va bene. Well, you'd like to do what?
I would like to vote for Prime Minister.
Yeah, I'm sure you could. Well,
who would you want to vote for?
You need to, well, Aldi, you need to get a UK passport, which you're probably entitled after you've been here for quite a long time and, you know, paid your council taxes and not been in trouble with the law and paid your congestion charge and all that sort of thing. I'm sure that the, you know, the, and people do naturalise.
You can be dual national anyway.
Naturalise after.
Italy,
yes, definitely. Yeah. There's no reason at all, Aldi, why you shouldn't be able to do that. But listen, turning to your question
tax.
About the tax on family homes,
well,
such
mansions.
Such as yours, Aldi. There's no question at all.
Yes.
This is a tax on London. This is an attack on London and the South East, where the overwhelming majority of such homes are to be found. There will be many people, and I don't know whether you're one of them, who are living through no fault of their own in a home that has massively inflated in value through simple operation of external market forces, and they are suddenly going to be clobbered. Absolutely clobbered with an annual tax of sometimes tens of thousands of pounds out of their income, which they simply can't afford to pay. And it is no wonder, Aldi, actually, that all the Labour candidates for Mayor of London, so Tessa Jowell and Margaret Hodge and David Lammy, they all came out strongly against this mansion tax, because they know it's basically unfair, it's unjust, and by the way, it won't do anything to help people in the London housing market. Quite the reverse. So you're seeing
what are you going to do to stop it?
uncertainty about international investment in London, which is actually something that enables us to build new homes.
What will you do to stop it?
Well, I think the best, the most effective way to stop an imposition of a new tax on family homes in London and the South East is not to have Ed Miliband in Downing Street. That's the best answer.
But all that's going to be taxed is the amount of over £1 million. So if someone's home is worth £1.25 million, it's the £250,000 that is going to be taxed. What is the problem? If one, as Nick Clegg would say, well, those with the broader shoulders bearing someone's
yes,
pay.
But there are many people. But there are many. It's because it's a tax on income, and many people simply don't have the income to pay, you know, 2% of £250,000.
But then they don't have to pay it until the house is sold. Then it's not until it is realised. They've said that as well, haven't they? An elderly couple living in Twickenham, they've got no problems as and when the house has to be sold. They just store it up.
Well, and so what's
the problem with that?
Well, because that will inevitably be taken off the value of their home when they come to sell it. I happen to agree with you, but that's
what Nick Clegg would say. House worth £2.5 million, right? Because I believe it's £2 million they're bringing in. Actually, my apologies. So we're only taxing the £500,000. Right. If it is someone's very fixed income, just living on their savings, don't worry, we don't need it. You will obviously tick it up, the clock will tick, but eventually you'll have to pay.
So you only pay this when you sell the home.
When they die.
Yeah. Does that apply to everybody?
No, if they can't afford it, if they've got fixed income and they can't pay.
Well, how do you tell them that's...
But it's not my idea.
Well,
Nick Clegg told me, sitting in that seat. I'm not supporting it, I'm putting
it's
it
It's a load of absolute cobblers. It would be a nightmare. It would be a nightmare.
An official expression.
It would be a nightmare for people on fixed incomes who would suddenly...
Who would suddenly
find themselves hit with this unexpected tax just because they're sitting in a home that has... That is in a neighbourhood where the values have gone up.
You're angry with me. I'm only putting the other line forward.
Well, and I do think you should get angry about it. I'm not angry. I thought you were angry. And you should be angry about it.
Okay.
Because it's an unjust attack on London. And by the way, it will, you know, I think it's very striking how Tessa and all the other Labour candidates have denounced it. I think they're right to denounce it, and I hope that Ed Miliband will drop it.
Right.
Can we go to David in Enfield, please?
David, go ahead.
Good morning, Barry.
Good morning,
Barry. Good morning.
Hello.
Boris, in the forthcoming election, which of these two should the voters be more concerned about? Ed Miliband's difficulty meeting a bacon sandwich, or your party chairman, Greg Shepps, telling porky pies on his recent LBC interview concerning his second job when he was an MP?
Well, just on Ed Miliband, I think the problem with Ed Miliband is his sandwich eating or anything like that. I don't think that's the issue at all. I think the issue, the problem with Ed Miliband and the Labour Party is basically that they want to take this country back to the 1970s, and they want to festoon British business with regulation. They think they have an overt admiration for the way things are done in France, where they have unemployment now running at about 12%. You've got huge numbers of talented French people fleeing France at the moment because it's a crazed socialist 1970s version of the European economy, and that is the problem with Ed, in my view. Now on Grant Shapps, I think Grant has done a terrific job as a party chairman. I think he's one of the best party chairmen I can remember the Conservative Party in modern times. And I think that the whole issue of his interests, his private sector interests that he had, I think this is really being flammed up by people who helped.
Oh, Mr. Mayor.
Who hate the wealth creating sector, who hate the idea that somebody could actually have an interest in private business as well. And
that's not what he was asked whether he had continued another job, and he categorically told my LBC colleague Sheila Fogarty he hadn't once he'd become an MP, and he had. I'll be as palatable. He misled us.
Well, hang on. As charitable. How long did he continue? It was a complete storm in a teacup.
You can't be a little bit pregnant. What difference?
I'm asking you the question. Because I think he
you're
was
You're the chairman of the Conservative Party. You're asked a pretty fundamental question. Well, it's either yes or no. It's not a...
As far as I can understand the situation, there was absolutely no impropriety involved. He was perfectly entitled to do what he was doing.
He either lied or forgot.
Well,
I'm sure it's
the second. It doesn't sound to me as though if there was an overlap, it wasn't very long. Right. And basically, people are bashing this guy because he was so enterprising as to set up his own business
not the problem at all.
You know, published lots of interesting material about how to get rich or something.
That's the problem.
Why shouldn't he? I don't care if he's got as many jobs as Miliband has kitchens. I don't care.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.